It's a little-known chapter in the history of the Ford Motor Company, and all that's left today are ruins and a ghost town deep in the Amazon rainforest. Here now to tell us the story of Henry Ford's great social and business experiment nearly a century ago in Brazil is Matt Anderson. He's curator of transportation for the Henry Ford. So good to have you back on the program, Matt.
Thank you.
So this was all about rubber, wasn't it?
It was. Ford was a big believer in vertical integration. He wanted to own and build every single part of the vehicles that he was building at the Ford Rouge factory there. So he wanted to own rubber plantations so he could have rubber to build the tires and other parts, seals and so on, for the cars.
He wasn't very delighted with the fact that at that time, say 100 years ago, the British and the Dutch, right, didn't they pretty much control the world's rubber?
Yes, they pretty much had a racket on it operating out of the East Indies. So he was looking to set up his own operation in the Western Hemisphere.
So he creates something called Fordlandia. What was it? Where was it? And what year are we talking about?
He creates Fordlandia in the late 1920s. About 1927 is when he starts purchasing land. And he purchases it on the Tapajos River, which is a tributary of the Amazon. So fairly deep into the jungle there. And basically just builds a planned community town and rubber plantation out of nothing.
It's fascinating to think about what he put in there. What kind of resources and support systems did he offer workers?
He really almost transported a Dearborn-style community and built it, as I say, from nothing in the middle of the jungle there. He built houses. There was electricity. There were appliances. There was a cafeteria. He had entertainment for the workers there, though it was the entertainment that he preferred, so it would have been sort of old-time square dances and so forth. But no, he really did try to provide a model lifestyle, or at least what he would have considered here in Dearborn or in the Midwest to be a model lifestyle, which wasn't necessarily to the taste of the natives.
And there you go. When you think about, I think a lot of us today would say, wow, you know, free food, shelter, medical care, a pool, a hospital, tailors, restaurants, shoemakers, it's all there. We'd say, sign us up. But somehow the idea of you must go to square dances and poetry readings and women can't drink and you're going to live in the kind of house that would look normal in Dearborn, that didn't set right, did it?
It did not. I think a couple of the big issues were, one, the food, because Ford was just feeding them the typical Midwestern meat and potatoes, which wasn't necessarily palatable to the local diet. The other big issue was that he imposed the factory system of work there, that the idea that you would work shifts from 9 to 5, say. And that didn't sit very well with the natives because they just didn't work that way because of the heat down there. They would like to work in the morning before the heat of the day or in the evening, and Ford wasn't having that. So that was a real source of conflict.
How badly did things boil over?
Things got pretty bad. There were about 3 days of riots in 1930 or so where the workers just kind of had enough, and they very notably destroyed just about every vehicle they could find. Those were, of course, very obvious symbols of Ford Motor Company and its power. And they also, interestingly, made a point of destroying the time clock. So it's pretty clear what was getting on their nerves there.
And at the same time, Matt, weren't there problems actually getting the rubber plants to grow and grow well?
There were. And one of Ford's flaws, for all of his strengths, was that he never much cared for experts. So he did not consult experts in the growing of rubber or in botany of any kind. When he set up this operation, he thought he could just bring his own kind of plant managers from the Rouge, send them down there, and they could manage everything just fine. It didn't work out that way. They had a couple of problems. One with just the incessant rains down there would wash away the topsoil, so it took them a while to learn that they had to terrace the land, plant the trees up on rows, levels, if you will, to keep the topsoil in place. And they also had problems with fungus. They would plant the trees too close together so that if one tree got infected, before long, many, many more trees were infected as well.
I'm talking with Matt Anderson of the Henry Ford about a fascinating chapter in the Ford Motor Company history when Henry Ford decided to set up a self-sustaining rubber operation deep in the Amazon rainforest in Brazil. And the first one, Fordlandia, fell victim to all kinds of problems. But let's try it again. And he tried a second plantation called Belterra.
He did. He sort of wisens up, takes his lumps in 1933, and establishes Belterra just a little further up the river from where Fordlandia was. And this time, he does bring in experts, and they do try to do it right. And sure enough, they do manage to start producing some rubber. Not nearly enough, I'm afraid, for it to be of any use to Ford. They never did quite get to commercial levels of production. But the fact that they were able to start it at all, I think, is something of a testament to what they tried down there.
And I'm surprised that it didn't really take root and go, because you got to figure during World War II, Southeast Asia sources would have been off limits, and I would have thought rubber would have been very important to the war effort.
It certainly was, and you would have thought that would have been the golden opportunity to finally turn Fordlandia around and make it a profitable business. But the problem was the government put so much money into research for artificial rubber, and indeed they were able to develop that. And when that happened, the market for natural rubber from Fordlandia had all but evaporated. So that was it.
The death knell for Belterra and Fordlandia. When did the Ford company throw in the towel and say enough?
Ford finally pulls out by about 1945. They'd put in close to $20 million over this period of time investing in this operation. They sold the land for about $250,000. So not a profitable venture at all.
Not one of those shining moments in bookkeeping, was it?
Not at all.
What's there today?
Surprisingly, some of those buildings still stand today, and most of them are not maintained. They've just been kind of left there to rot on their own. But it's I've read the stories, seen the pictures online. It's the most bizarre thing. You're traveling down this river, sort of in the middle of nowhere, and then you come around a corner, and there's this North American style water tower, kind of reaching up above the tree line, and it's just incredible how much does survive still.
What lessons do you think, Matt, were learned that maybe perhaps carries over to present day foreign operations?
Well, I think one lesson was learned, that you just can't be stubborn. And again, that was one of Ford's flaws. I think he probably should have pulled out of Fordlandia a lot earlier, but he just wasn't willing to give up. He just believed that he could get this thing done. That was part of the problem. And another lesson that was learned is, there are limits to how big a company can grow and limits to the advantages in vertical integration. It sounds good on paper to control all of your resources, all of your production steps and methods, but there comes a point where the economies of scale just aren't there anymore, and it's more trouble than it's worth.
Fascinating story from Matt Anderson, Curator of Transportation for the Henry Ford. And always a pleasure to talk with you and talk history with you. Thank you so much, Matt.
Thank you.